The race to contain a new COVID-19 variant. Countries are closing their borders, reimposing travel restrictions and quarantine measures. A clear sign the pandemic is far from over. But are governments prepared to deal with the ever-changing virus? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Darin Abugaida. So just as countries around the world were starting to reopen their borders and lift COVID-19 restrictions, a new variant is now threatening to derail the progress of the past few months. Several nations have already imposed travel restrictions to and from southern Africa. That's where the latest variant was first detected. The World Health Organization says it poses a high global risk. So governments have been put on notice. Be prepared. Little is known about the new strain, but there are fears it may be highly infectious and more resistant to vaccines. More than 2 years since the start of the pandemic, it shows no signs of ending. Health officials are urging nations to speed up their vaccination drives. We'll bring in our guests in just a moment, but first, here's more from the head of the WHO, who's urged countries to work together to fight the pandemic.
We understand and support every government's responsibility to protect its own people. It's natural. But vaccine equity is not charity. It's in every country's best interests. No country can vaccinate its way out of the pandemic alone. The longer vaccine inequity persists, the more opportunity this virus has to spread and evolve in ways we cannot predict nor prevent.
Let's now bring in our guests. Joining us from Cambridge in the UK is Dr. Dipti Gurdasani, who's a senior lecturer at Queen Mary University of London. In Addis Ababa, Dr. Ahmed Ogwel Uma, the deputy director at the Africa Centres for Disease Control and Prevention. Over in Oxford, Michael Jacobs is the Professor of Political Economy at the University of Sheffield in the UK. A warm welcome to you all. Thanks so much for joining us on Inside Story. Dr. Gurdasani, so just about a year ago when vaccination started rolling out, the belief by some was that life could certainly return to normal. Just when things seemed to be looking up, infection started increasing again in some countries, as you know, and now we have this new concerning variant. Are you surprised by this or did you expect this to happen?
No, I'm not at all surprised. In fact, a lot of that rhetoric has come from politicians, particularly in the West, where the idea has been, let's live with the virus and return to normal. Scientists have been warning for a while that that's not possible with a virus that's been adapting continuously towards becoming more transmissible, potentially more severe and more able to escape vaccines. So this variant was entirely predictable because we've had, I think, a new variant arise almost every 3 to 4 months. And this is sort of right on time with predictions that many people have made. Unfortunately, we've been largely ignored by governments who want life to return to normal, but aren't really taking steps needed to ensure that variants don't continue to arise in the way that they are.
Michael Jacobs, I see you nodding along. What's your take on this?
I think I bow to the scientific experts. It is pretty clear that with a coronavirus that is mutating so rapidly, the ones that will emerge are the ones that are more transmissible and more resistant to the vaccine. That's why they emerge. And this does mean, I think, that until the world is fully vaccinated, we are going to have to live with it in the sense that we're not going to be able to go back to normal. This is the new normal. And so a world of at least wearing masks, physical distancing, restrictions on travel, I think is inevitable for several years yet. And the really worrying thing is the world has not made a huge amount of progress in vaccinating entire populations. You know, most European countries have about 70% fully vaccinated now. In the UK, in the US, it's less than that. It's more like 60. Most African countries, it's still under 5%. The South Africa, where this new variant seems to have arisen, is only 25%, despite being a richer African country. These levels of vaccination make it inevitable that we are going to see this virus across the globe, and that will continue to give us huge economic disruption and huge increases in poverty.
All right, all important points, which I'll address in just a moment. But first, let me bring in Ahmed Ogwel Omar from Addis Ababa. Sir, Omicron has been classified as a variant of concern, as you know. What does the data available so far tell us about its infection risk? And will it become the dominant strain, do you think, or is it too early to say so?
No, thank you for having me. Let me start by correcting the previous speaker, who has alluded to Omicron virus having been coming from South Africa. That is incorrect. The correct position is that it is impossible to know where a variant first appears. The more efficient scientists are the ones who are going to be declaring that they have characterized a particular variant. And that's what South Africa, indeed Botswana, have done. It is the efficiency of their system that is now being turned around to label this particular variant as something that has happened in southern part of Africa. Let me shift to your question. We don't know a lot about this particular variant, but the fact of the matter is we know, we expected from the very beginning that we are going to be having different variants. That is the way viruses are. They are going to mutate over time. So it is not a surprise. What is surprising is the panic that we are seeing across the globe. By the time a virus, a new variant has been characterized, it has been circulating within the globe. And it is very difficult to then try and close doors and pretend that it may not come into one particular community. What we need to do is to understand what this new variant is all about. We still don't have enough information to do that. And then we react appropriately. And the appropriate reaction is to use all the tools at our disposal. Vaccines is just one of them. We must go back to all the other tools, public health measures, masking up, sanitizing, providing the correct information and not panicking so that we can stay ahead of this pandemic. Otherwise, if we panic, it will always be ahead of us.
So, okay, Ahmed Ogwel Omar, is this then the new normal as you speak of? Sanitizing, mask wearing, vaccines? Are people just going to have to learn how to live with lockdowns and restrictions and vaccines and screenings for the foreseeable future?
What is definitely going to happen is we are going to be living in an environment that is different from the pre-pandemic days. There is absolutely no doubt about that. We can, however, be able to bring this to a stop if we act together. Acting on our own individual countries, communities, is not going to stop the pandemic. This is a global problem, and we must approach it from a global perspective, where each and every tool is available to each and every part of the world, then we can be able to bring this to a stop, and some of the restrictions will then be able to be removed. But so long as we continue to look at this from a very nationalistic spectacles, we are not going to have it end. And any new variant that will come is not going to be able to be contained in one country or one region. It will spread. So we must act together so that we can be able to remove these restrictions and continue with life relatively more comfortably than it is now.
Dr. Gurdasani, is that something you agree with? Also, the president of South Africa himself described the emergence of this new variant as a wake-up call for the world regarding particularly vaccine inequality. And he warned that until everybody was vaccinated, then more variants were actually inevitable. So with countries and populations having different access to vaccines, as we know, is he right?
Yes, I mean, frankly, this has been obvious from when the pandemic started. I mean, you need a globally coordinated approach of progressive elimination. This is not a virus that you can live with because, as I said, you will see new versions of this virus emerge, each one potentially worse than the previous. But you don't just need a coordinated vaccine strategy. So definitely there needs to be global equity. There's no doubt about that. And there's also no doubt that there's been massive hoarding of vaccines in the West that has sort of pushed COVAX to the end of the queue, despite there being a huge need there. But I think there also needs to be a coordinated effort to deal with misinformation and vaccine hesitancy, which is impacting, I think, all parts of the world, including South Africa. And I think unless we have all of that with a focus on, you know, as Professor Emmett said, every tool in the toolbox. So it's not just vaccines, but high grade masks, things that work with airborne transmission, like ventilation, really good surveillance systems. We will not be able to get on top of this. So it's essentially using every layer that we have and ensuring that there is no country that's disadvantaged because of lack of access or shortages or lack of infrastructure, as well as dealing with the huge amount of misinformation that's spread across multiple avenues, including social media.
Michael Jacobs, what do you think that governments need to do to manage this virus in a sort of more effective way so we can get back to our normal lives?
Well, I certainly agree that we need to be sharing vaccines more equitably across the world. We recently, apparently in the UK, destroyed 600,000 vaccines, which had gone past their effective date, which is an absolute moral disgrace and economic disaster. It is really appalling that the Western countries and Gulf states and others have not been enabling greater vaccination in the rest of the world. And as has been said by various leaders, including the head of the WHO, as you heard earlier, none of us are safe until everybody is. But I also agree that this problem of disinformation and vaccine hesitancy is a huge problem. In the US, it looks very unlikely that they will ever be able to get to a herd immunity because very large numbers of people, almost entirely associated with supporters of the Republican Party, do not believe in vaccinations and in many cases seem to believe that the whole COVID thing is a hoax. Now, that is a kind of not just disinformation, but a kind of political war on health and on equity. And many countries around the world see this, where you've got vaccine hesitancy bound up with wider mistrust of governments, of professionals, of experts and so on. And this is a real problem which we have to address in every country where this occurs.
Right, Michael, but how difficult is it to balance what scientists want in terms of wiping out this virus and what society and populations need in terms of function and well-being?
I think from an economic point of view, it is very difficult. There's no question that as you restrict certain kinds of contact and travel, that certain sectors of the economy will be hurt. The travel industry, tourism in particular, the UN Conference on Trade and Development has estimated that the economic cost across the world, particularly from the loss of travel and tourism, might go up to $4 trillion last year and this year. So that is a huge economic cost. And it's obviously much harder for people and industries where most workers can't work from home. In manual labour sectors, the option of working from home, which is possible for white-collar office workers, doesn't exist. So this will have, is having a huge economic cost. But in the end, a pandemic which we don't get rid of will have a larger economic cost. And so, yes, of course, this is a balance. Some countries seem to have balanced this better than others. In other places, the restrictions have been minimized because of political opposition. There's a kind of strand of libertarianism that's definitely true in my own country, in the UK and in the US, which sees even things as simple as mask wearing as incursions on personal liberty. That kind of attitude is not helping. That is making the situation worse.
Stand by for just a moment. We'll delve into the economic discussion a little bit more, but take a look at these statistics. So as we mentioned earlier, this new variant is threatening to undo the recent economic recovery, if there was one. Millions of people lost their jobs when businesses were forced to close during the initial wave of the pandemic. Global supply chains are still severely disrupted as a result of staff shortages. Many ports are clogged with shipments, causing supply shortfalls as well as rising prices. And the International Monetary Fund predicts the cost of food and gas will rise by 4.3% this year. And that is the biggest jump since 2011. And on the issue of travel in particular, Ahmed Ogwel Oma, the president of South Africa, I'm sure you know, has called on countries which have imposed recent travel bans on his country as well as some other regional countries to urgently reverse their decisions. That's what he says, before any further damage is done to our economies. So knowing that the UK, EU and US are among some of those who've imposed those travel bans, do you think they're going to make a difference in fighting this variant?
Travel bans don't work. We have seen it with, and this is not the first variant that we have faced. When we started with the Alpha and the Beta, the Delta, we have very good evidence that travel bans do not work. In fact, during this time of Omicron, we have seen, as of my last count, at least 12 countries have reported documenting the Omicron variant. So closing down economies of by banning travel from one part of the world to another is not going to help.
But when you say that you have evidence, I wonder if you can just tell us a little bit about what that evidence is.
Look, if you go to each and every type of variant, the only way for you to be able to know which variant you're dealing with is to do full genome sequencing. So if a country is doing full genome sequencing, they will be able to tell what kind of variant they're dealing with. Not all countries are doing that. Some countries are doing it, especially here in Africa. We are doing that very, very effectively. And when we share that data, we are punished for it. Second is, when you look at the way that the variants are being identified across the world, it is not following a linear path from one country to the other. It is popping up even amongst people who cannot be able to be said to have traveled anywhere or come into contact with someone else who had traveled. So it means that the way in which these variants are actually traveling across the world, we cannot yet be able to define it effectively. And if we can't define the pathway, then closure of borders is not going to help. But it is damaging our response in two very important ways. One is that it is going to discourage countries from doing any full genome sequencing and sharing their data. That is damaging. And second, economically speaking, by starting to label countries as sources of different types of variants, we are going to start affecting not only response of the public to vaccination, but also the economic damage that is going to be caused is going to be more. If we deal with this as we are dealing with variants and not parts of the world, then we are going to be a lot more effective. But travel bans do not work, have never worked, are not going to work with this variant or any other that will come up in the future.
Dr. Gurdasani, what is your opinion on this? Are the travel bans premature, an overreaction, or what's your take on it?
So by the time a variant is identified, it is widespread. So, you know, when it was identified, many of us said, yes, it's definitely here in England because of the transport links between different regions. That doesn't mean that slowing down import doesn't help. I mean, certainly that helps, but not through travel bans, through screening at the border and strong quarantine measures, and not targeted at single countries, but rather comprehensive ones that require isolation and testing of all travelers. And those measures have been shown to be highly effective in very large studies across many countries, but also with the caveat that they are effective because you're going to slow down spread, but then are you going to do something with that extra time that you gain? Because ultimately, cases will probably come through unless you have sort of very blanket restrictions like some countries in the Southeast have, which have kept variants out. And I don't see countries like the US and UK doing very much else with that time. I mean, that time needs to be urgently used to put in domestic measures that reduce transmission, to reduce existing case rates, to build healthcare capacity, to increase vaccination and boosting. Unless that time is used to do that, it's sort of going to be wasted.
So I'll ask you the question that we put at the top of the show, and is this going to be the new normal, Dr. Gurdasani? Should people continue to expect travel bans? I know that Ahmed Ogwel Omah doesn't necessarily agree with them, but should people be expecting this to be their new normal? They should face travel bans every couple of months because of the coronavirus.
I think it depends on the political will. I mean, if there is a globally coordinated effort towards elimination, then things like quarantines and travel restrictions and other restrictions will be in the shorter term. But, and by shorter term, I still mean, unfortunately, over the course of a few years, you know, like we did with measles, we eliminated it, but gradually. But if that's not the course that we're choosing, and if the course is living with the virus, then I'm afraid we're dealing with longer term restrictions. So paradoxically, I find the focus on short-term freedoms and short-term economic gains has trumped the science, which means that we are living in longer-term restrictions and much, much greater economic damage. And I think at this point, it's time for politicians and scientists to reflect on, you know, can we make a globally coordinated effort which requires short-term pain, but, you know, does not require us living with a virus that's constantly mutating to potentially become more transmissible and more able to escape the tools that we have.
So, Michael Jacobs, how do then governments balance keeping their economies afloat on one end while protecting populations from transmission? And is their strategy this time around going to have to be different than last time around?
The strategies in countries that are more vaccinated is different. So lockdowns are occurring less than they used to, although we've now seen new lockdowns in certain European countries because transmission has extended far enough. But that will be different in many countries from before. I think many industries have become better at adapting to the situation where people can work from home. People have obviously got used to that. In other sectors, we've got better logistics, which have kept people apart from one another, better ventilation of buildings and so on. So between industry and government, we've seen some forms of adaptation, which have meant that the economic costs have not been as great. But then if we don't succeed in vaccinating very large numbers of the population globally and not just in certain countries, these things won't be fully effective. It's a very difficult choice for governments because the economic costs are very considerable. You have obviously the direct health costs of people getting the disease, but you have huge economic costs from making it more difficult for people to work and to consume and to produce. And those have real health costs themselves. People become ill, people are poorer, then they can't access healthcare themselves and so on. So this is a very difficult balancing act and there aren't simple solutions.
So what you're saying is that economic inequality will worsen then, Michael Jacobs, if the situation continues as is?
Economic inequality will worsen under either leaving the pandemic to go its own way or restricting the economy much more deeply. Neither choice is good for poor people because poor people have fewer options always. And so, yes, inequality is likely to rise. This is why it's so important that governments extend the vaccination programs, particularly in the donation of vaccines from rich countries to poorer countries, because in the end, that is the only way we will get a control of this and the only way we can find some degree of equitable outcome. And I just want to say about travel bans, any form of travel restriction is an economic cost to the countries involved in that travel. So even if you don't ban people, if you quarantine them, if you force them to have tests, which they have to pay for, you will have a restriction on the amount of travel. That is, I'm afraid, inevitable in a pandemic that travels so quickly across borders. So whether or not it's actual bans or whether it's just better quarantining, vaccination, testing processes, that will impact on travel with an economic cost.
Ahmed Ogwel Umah, to what extent do you think this crisis, this pandemic, has really been a revelation on weaknesses that exist in how we all live together?
Absolutely. And in fact, the weaknesses have been across board. All types of communities and countries, all types of strata in as far as social strata is concerned, all of us have been exposed in different ways. Now, two things I would like to add to that. One is we do have tools at our disposal that we need to use to slow this down so that we can be able to perform adequate economic activities. One is testing. We have rapid tests now, which give you results in a matter of minutes, and we need to use these more effectively so that we can be able to identify hotspots quickly and put out the spread as fast as possible before it goes into other parts of the country, other parts of the world. So effective testing needs to be ramped up. Second is vaccination. we need to vaccinate. That way we can reduce the number of people who are going to be seriously ill and therefore put less pressure on our health systems and also have fewer people who can be able to spread the virus more efficiently. And finally, is information. Human beings, by and large, if they're given correct information, they tend to react in a positive way. There'll always be that part of society that will not be able to react in a positive way. The way that we transmit that information, how fast we do it, and how effectively it reaches the population is critical in ensuring that the population is with those who are responsible for guiding and coordinating this response. And currently, we are not doing enough of providing that information, and we need to do it more effectively.
Okay, on that note, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Deepti Gurdasani, Dr. Ahmed Ogwell Oma, and Michael Jacobs. We appreciate your time. Thanks for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. For further discussion, you can go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is AJInsideStory from myself and the whole team here in Doha. Thanks for watching. Bye-bye for now.